And now to explore these issues further, let's turn to the next edition of our Points of View series. The show sat down with Lindsay Ashworth of the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence, Christopher Tiffany with the social services group Raising Special Kids, and KJZZ's own Kathy Ritchie, who you just heard from there. We wanted to know what is being done to help vulnerable adults and their families, not only in cases of abuse, but also when it comes to consensual relationships. The first question I had for this was for Kathy about how far we've come or how far we haven't come since Hacienda.
Well, you know, I talked to a lot of people for that feature, and, you know, there were some efforts shortly after this happened. I know Senator Carter had her bill, SB 1211, which closed that loophole, which essentially exempted Hacienda from being licensed. So that has since been closed. Other than that, from what I understand, not a lot has changed. We have the recommendations that came out in November from the governor's task force, and that to me seems like a really strong foundation to begin dealing with some of the gaps that exist in the system. Representative Jennifer Longdon and her colleague, Representative Tim Dunn, they also came out with some recommendations from the legislative standpoint in early December. So we'll have to kind of wait and see what happens with that when the session starts. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where we're at now. We have a framework with the governor's task force and those recommendations. So I think it's really just a matter of them going through them and figuring out what they can implement and figuring out the cost of all of that.
Yeah. So we'll talk about some of those gaps here coming up. But so this case coming out of Hacienda was unique, of course, because this victim in this case was incapacitated, could not have consented. But there are varying degrees of vulnerability. So I sort of want to start by defining terms so we know what we're talking about. When we say a vulnerable adult, I know this was a conversation in the newsroom when this story hit. Do we call her an incapacitated woman? I mean, how do we refer to people, and what do we mean when we say something like vulnerable adults? Either of you can take that one.
Sure, I can start. In the context of a vulnerable adult, in the eyes of Raising Special Kids in the organization that I work for, our services and supports are really designed to serve parents and family members of children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So we're talking about individuals with autism, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and cognitive disability or intellectual disability. So that, in my opinion, would be a population of vulnerable adults.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, in the newsroom, how did we come to the decision about how to refer to this woman in this particular case and what happened to her? And then how have you taken that through the rest of your reporting on the broader population?
I mean, this is a woman who was not... Yes, she had limitations. She was not able to consent, but she could feel. Mm-hmm. She could feel pain. She could respond to people that she knew. She enjoyed, I think there was the notice of claim that was actually filed by her attorney in May talked about how she responded to positive stimuli, like, her, you know, a family member coming in, holding her hand, music, that sort of thing. And she could also feel pain. So, yes, she was incapacitated, but she was not comatose mm-hmm. by any means. She could experience certain things.
Yeah.
Also, when talking about specific diagnoses, I think it's more appropriate to talk about the individual's ability to consent. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if it's an individual that has a disability that doesn't allow them to say yes or say no, not necessarily to say it, but to understand those terms, that to me also would be an individual that would be a vulnerable adult.
Sure.
Or a vulnerable child.
So I would add that we know that, people with intellectual developmental disabilities are 7 times more likely to experience sexual assault. And actually, Native folks are also at an increased risk to experience sexual violence. About 1 in 3 Native women will experience rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. So when we're talking about vulnerability across different identities, mm-hmm. That is also another identity to bring forth when we're talking about this woman in particular.
Yeah. Then let's talk about training, about having parents, caregivers, people who are around vulnerable adults understand and be able to recognize the signs that somebody may not be able to communicate that mm-hmm. they have been abused, but that they are being abused or have been abused. What does that look like? How do you tell people, teach people how to do that?
So I think I even want to take a step back a bit and address, you know, I think we touched on the myth that people with disabilities are asexual and they're not sexual beings. And we know that's just not the case. But with the myth of asexuality in this population comes that, you know, they can't have consensual sex. They can't be sexually abused because they aren't sexual beings. So I first just kind of want to address that myth. I think as far as signs, the traumatic impact looks different for everybody. It's individualized on that person. So, you know, we know sexual violence is an embodied experience, so it affects someone's body. And so when we look at maybe some physical signs, someone might experience frequent headaches or stomach pains really past that one instance or multiple instances of the actual assault. Trauma affects, you know, hormones of the entire body. So we might see someone exhibit behaviors that differ from their normal behavior. So they might be withdrawn. They might be irritable. They might even experience some guilt or shame about what happened to them, so they don't want to talk about it. It's really going to be individualized based on that survivor, that victim, and what their normal is and kind of what the behavior changes are.
Yeah. And that was something that was brought up in the task force, too, that the trauma-informed approach when it comes to reporting, was it?
Yeah, so I was a part of the work group that talked about really the recovery after sexual assault. So once that is reported, once we know that someone has been sexually assaulted, how do we support that survivor and their family in healing it? So that is something that we talked about. I think as far as the trauma-informed piece, we want to make sure that we create environments that are healing-centered and healing-focused where empowerment can occur. When someone is sexually assaulted, their power is taken away, right? Their choice to consent was taken away. And so I think it's important when we're looking at the environments that we're creating for survivors and their families, that it is one filled with trust and empowerment and overall exercising choice.
Yeah. I want to turn to you, Chris, because you work on the sort of the kids' end of this, right?
Sure.
And families as well. But how much of this in your mind is about having good communication within families when kids who might end up in this population or who were born into it are really young?
Parents and caregivers and family members know their kids well. And so families are going to know if something's going on with their kid. The purpose of our training is to really help parents and caregivers, helping them to identify barriers in talking about sexuality, providing information and training about sexuality and sexual abuse, and providing resources to build practice skills in talking about it. And that's really the key right there is helping those young people with the accurate language. So, for example, the accurate language of their body parts. And so when they have that information, they're more likely to report abuse to their parents or caregivers. And as a result of Hacienda, we did get more calls about, whoa, how do I protect my child? How do I talk to my child about sexuality? And that really is about that communication piece and teaching parents how to have those conversations that might be difficult for them from their own experience growing up and how their family thought about sexuality.
Yeah. So from your point of view, it sounds like it's the right time to start talking about these issues with a kid is early, is when they're young.
Yeah, and really, you know, ideally it should be an ongoing part of the conversation of a child's development. I think that families, you know, families of children with intellectual and developmental disabilities are really forced to make choices on what to focus on in their child's therapy and their development and their schooling and education. Mm-hmm. And this type of thing, sexuality education, doesn't necessarily always rise to the surface.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just wondering, Christopher, if you could talk a little bit about, since we're talking about having this conversation at a very young age, one of the things that I had learned, one of the challenges are these blurred boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if either one of you could speak to that, especially if a child has very intense needs where they may have a caregiver who helps them bathe, dress.
Sure.
So really those boundaries of what's appropriate and what's not are very blurry, starting at a very young age.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll give my own family as an example. My child has autism, and socialization was a huge thing that we worked on, having him around his therapists and his care providers and teachers, doing things like giving hugs. That was difficult for him when he was early on. Mm-hmm. And so now he's 13 years old, and he's giving big hugs to people, and that's not appropriate. So now we're looking at, okay, what do we have to do to really make sure that he understands personal space and boundaries? additionally with self-care and families that have children that have attendant care needs and bathroom and bathing and going to the swimming pool. What do we teach our children on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and what's an appropriate touch and what's an inappropriate touch? Absolutely.
Yeah. I also think we, you know, can talk to our kids as early as like 2 and 3, right, about boundaries and affectionate consent. And an example that I have done, you know, with my family members and young kids in my life is asking, can I hug you? Mm-hmm. Right. And if they say no, then I say, OK, you know, that's OK. How about a handshake? Right. No. OK. You know, that's OK. And teaching them that their body is their own body and no one, even a family member. Right. Because we know that the majority of the time it's a family or a close friend that is abusing these people. And so just teaching them that they have bodily autonomy and that they can say no when they want to.
Yeah. We do a lot of fist bumps with my 2-year-old.
There you go.
But that brings up a question I had here, which is about the situation that arises, which is common, right? That the abuser is somebody they know, somebody who is in the family, a friend of the family, maybe a caregiver, et cetera. That makes it even more confusing. It makes it even harder, especially if it's a child. How do you empower them from a young age? Is it about giving language to it? Is it about giving ownership? Like, what are some of the strategies that both of you teach families and kids at that age to sort of provide those boundaries, especially when they might be in situations that get really blurry, like you have somebody who bathes you every day and you have somebody who helps you dress?
We just always try to help parents understand to trust their instincts when it comes to their kids. And if, you know, if their kid isn't acting right and something doesn't look right, then it's time to start asking questions. And if that means asking questions of teachers, of therapists, of, you know, other siblings in the household or your spouse, you know, that's parents need to trust their instincts.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, do you guys run into situations where you have a parent who says, you know, maybe when that child is now an adult or close to becoming an adult, well, you know, they just don't see that as being a concern. Rather, they're like, they just don't think about that or they don't want to think about that. And how do you deal with that?
We do see that quite a bit, actually. Families that may be in some sort of denial that their child is a sexual human being. We try to provide information, good information in front of them, accurate information from high-quality sources. At the end of the day, families, their experiences are going to be their best teacher. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can get them out to a training. Hopefully we can get them out there and change their minds.
I was at a training recently. It was for self-advocates, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. So there were two individuals who were there. No, there were four. And they were learning how to have this conversation with other people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, are you starting to see more of that where you have self-advocates who are taking these tools and sharing it with others? Because it does feel like we're not talking about this enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're seeing it more now than I've ever seen it. I've been with the organization for 9 years. Hacienda was a tragedy, absolutely, but it has brought a very important topic to the surface. And I think that talking about it the way that we are, getting self-advocates involved, getting parents to the table, I think is a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's the only way it can work is having people with disabilities, having self-advocates at the table to create that curriculum, right? Or to teach their peers about this subject. I think really that's the only way it's going to work is for everyone to come together, especially self-advocates, to have their voice be heard and listened to.
Yeah. So then I want to end with a final discussion about what should change. As we asked Kathy at the beginning, right, like not a lot has changed on the policy front since this case kind of brought all of this to light, as you mentioned, Chris, last year. But what do you both think should be on the table? When you look at those recommendations, when you talk about the trainings that you do as organizations, and when you talk about the families that you work with every day, what would benefit them?
I think the executive order was a good start. The recommendations, Kathy, as you mentioned, were strong. What I really appreciated about the executive order is that it was meant to bring people together. Certainly, funding is always a challenge for anything, education, home community-based services, anything. But I think the more that we talk about this, the more families and individuals with disabilities will benefit.
Lindsay?
I think we need more sexual assault services that promote healing and can really provide that long-term support to survivors. Sexual assault programs that would be funded by the state-level funding, which we currently don't have, but we'll hopefully have this next legislative session, something at the coalition we've been advocating for a while. So those advocates and those victim service responders can walk with that survivor through their healing journey, because that survivorship never goes away, right? That survivorship really stays with that person throughout their entire life. That's something that we can all advocate for, is that state-level funding for sexual assault services.
You know, it's a safety issue, and I think the task force, and that was something that the governor's spokesperson had said, but accountability costs money at the end of the day, and to promote safety and education, it comes with a price tag. I don't know what that price tag is, but that's sort of been my takeaway from all of this. And my hope is that, you know, we can get it done, and I think time will tell. It's important for this population to understand what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate. And it's a big issue.
Yeah. All right. That is KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. She's joined by Lindsay Ashworth, the Sexual Violence Response Manager for the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence, as well as Christopher Tiffany, Executive Director of Raising Special Kids. Thank you all for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.